Hello, you are listening into America Unchained. My name is Chris Tidwell.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
We're sitting in a time frame of a historic, post-historic election. The race has been called with a handed victory to Joe Biden. And we're here today to talk about some of the many comments that have been made post-election and sort of a reflection on how the election went, both internal to a core Democratic Party and maybe on some of the more progressive fronts. And we'll see how these two, well, let's say movements within the party might be at odds with each other, the dynamics of how correct they might be always at stake. We'll also be talking a little bit today about the specifics, not just of a federal election, but of the state election that we've witnessed here in Georgia, which has been of prime conversation for a lot of the news media. So, Richard, to get us started, can you give us some of your thoughts maybe on these? There's been a lot of words said and some of the opinions on the left and also the centrist on a Joe Biden presidency.
Well, I do share the view of many that the victory of Biden and Harris over Trump and Pence was something of crucial significance for the future of our democracy. And I do think that another 4 years of the Trump regime would have disastrous consequences for our nation and for the world at large. And it's with a great amount of relief that I have emerged from these past week of nail-biting results until what earlier might have been seen as inevitable finally played itself out. So, you know, in a sense, I'm happy. I'm happy that Trump has been defeated, even if he's not willing to admit it. But I'm also disappointed. And I think many people share that disappointment because this has not been a blue wave election. This has not been an election that presented the kind of landslide victory one would expect when one has a presidency as corrupt, as incompetent, and as anti-democratic in character, as the Trump administration has been. One should have expected a tremendous landslide, even if there had not been a pandemic, but the mismanagement of the pandemic and the ensuing economic disaster that so many people in America have been undergoing, together with many throughout the world, would seem to be the icing on the cake. You know, the huge wake-up call, the perfect storm that would have pushed tens of millions of Americans to recognize they have to throw off this presidency if we are going to have any hope of getting beyond the contagion and the economic pain and suffering that so many people in this country have suffered. But it didn't turn out that way. And I think we really have to consider why it did not turn out that way. Why was there not a blue wave? Why was there not a crushing defeat to not just Trump, but all of the Republican candidates, or at least a huge percentage of those Republican candidates who have stood by him in slavish, spineless subservience? Now, this was an election that had a sizable turnout. It's expected that the turnout will reach 66% of eligible voters. That's greater than the election in 2016, which had about 60% of the votes. Now, keep in mind that we have relatively low voter turnouts compared to most other democracies. And that means when the victors are announced in any of our elections, we're talking about a victory that rests on the shoulders of at most a third of eligible voters. And that is the case in this election, where maybe at the end of the day, there'll be 66% of the voters, eligible voters, having participated. Well, a little bit more than half will have put their votes for Biden and Harris. I mean, currently, and when I say currently, I'm basing myself on today's figures from the New York Times, which represent something over 98% of the votes having been counted. Biden, as we all know, has currently clinched 279 Electoral College votes, which is enough to go over the 270 needed to be president-elect. He has received 75,352,073 votes, more than any other candidate in American history. And that's, however, only 50.5% of the votes that were cast. Because Donald Trump, who is now credited with having won 214 Electoral College votes, has received 71,087,203 votes so far, or 47.7% of total votes so far cast. That is the second highest total of votes received by any presidential candidate. And this involves a substantial increase on the part of Trump of what happened in 2016. In the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton received 48.2% of the votes with 65,853,514. Trump was victorious in the Electoral College with 46.1% of the vote, or 62,984,828 votes. So Trump has exceeded his vote total of 2016 by more than 8 million, and he's received a higher percentage of the votes cast, 47.7% as opposed to 46.1%. But fortunately, this time he has not managed to win the Electoral College. But I think these are pretty staggering totals, given the magnitude of the damage that the American people have suffered, all of which should have been reason for many more of the voters to have stood up and repudiated his regime by ending his presidency at one term in the ballot box. Now, the relatively strong showing of Trump is also exhibited, as we all know, in the races in the House of Representatives. The Democrats have lost a certain number of seats. Instead of having a blue wave where they would have increased their fairly sizable advantage in the House of Representatives, Democrats currently have lost 4 seats. The Republicans have gained 5. It's expected the Republicans might gain several more. And as we all know, in the Senate, the Democrats have not yet succeeded in turning the Senate blue. Right now, we are in a dead heat. 48 senators who are Democrats having clinched victory versus 48 Republicans. But as we in Georgia know all too well, the 2 seats in Georgia remain up for grabs because none of the Senate candidates in either Senate race managed to get above 50% and avoid a runoff. So this means that the races in Georgia are going to decide control of the Senate. And for that reason, they have a huge significance. And, you know, I think we need to look at those races in particular and consider what happened. That's what we find. We find a blue wave that did not happen but should have happened in this most perfect storm, in this huge wake-up call for the voters of America to turn in a new direction. But that blue wave did not materialize. Biden and Harris have managed to get through. The Democratic majority in the House of Representatives has diminished. The Senate remains up for grabs. So what we have to look forward to is something that has a rather mixed character, and we will discuss this in due time.
Yeah, there's certainly a complex. The national media will be heavily focused on Georgia and maybe some other salient races. The general consensus before this election seemed to be that with voter turnout, Democrats will always do better as sort of an axiom, which is always dangerous in politics. And I think this election proved a lot of problems maybe with that viewpoint. And the question of specific races, I mean, you see North Carolina had in very high number turnout. Georgia had a high number turnout. But you have maybe Democratic bastions and also sort of Republican bastions, non-competitive states, did not have turnout. So this goes to show maybe once that they felt partly disenfranchised, maybe by the Electoral College and people vote with that. But also, just interestingly enough, they felt like, well, their vote didn't mean as much. But certainly we've seen how that is not the case in a lot of very, very tight races. I guess, largely speaking, one of the concerns that I have maybe about the general federal election is, given the fact that voter turnout didn't crash into a blue wave, didn't turn out into a blue wave, I guess. Did we see, I guess, maybe some of the, I don't know how to say it, the rats in the floorboards of sorts that came out to those voters that we had no idea that might have been there? Is that, could that ultimately pose a problem for those Democratic races, maybe those progressive races that are trying to continue this elevation of voter turnout? It's just one of the conundrums that I think I'm focusing on, especially when it comes to the future of maybe Senate races and these special elections that are coming up. I don't know if there will be maybe an emboldenedness or maybe even anger that happens from the outing of Trump.
Well, you know, when people have begun the discussion after the results of the election have begun trickling in and finally indicated what the outcome is, you know, various kinds of recriminations have set in. And this is happening in particular on the Democratic side, because I think Republicans were expecting a loss. And I think many are surprised at how well Republicans have done. And, you know, there are many within the Democratic Party who are claiming that the reason for the modest success of the Democrats in this election, or I should say, modest success at the presidential level, losses in Congress, and we'll see to what degree there's much of a gain in the Senate, that this is due to the fact that the party allowed itself to be seduced by a progressive agenda that turned off voters. Now, I want to take this up, and I think there are two sides to it, because I think that the more centrist Democrats were presenting policies in a way that really allowed Trump and other Republican candidates to really dismiss what the Democrats represented, and to do so with a considerable amount of success among many voters who should have been attracted by what the Democratic Party had to offer. But on the other hand, I think there are also problems with what the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party had to offer and the way it did so. But I first want to discuss the problems with the more centrist message that in a way is personified by Biden. And I think you see it displayed very painfully in the debates. And I'm speaking more about the final debate that was less of a shouting match than the first one. Or I shouldn't say not a shouting match, but a series of interruptions by Trump. And In that debate, I think you found Trump very easily putting Biden in a very uncomfortable position by accusing Biden of wanting to end fracking and dismantle the fossil fuel industry, and in doing so, put in jeopardy the livelihoods of so many people who today rely upon it. Now, Biden, instead of speaking about how the transition to green energy is indeed going to evolve eventually shutting down fracking, as well as all the rest of fossil fuel exploration and production, had no real answer to Trump's accusation. Because what he failed to do, and has failed to do, is to advance any policy that would guarantee people jobs and employment. And that is something that has really put in question many, many of the policies that are put forward by Democrats. And Trump very aggressively pointed this out, you know, when in speaking about the whole issue of government regulations. Trump has been always saying that Democrats have imposed all sorts of requirements upon business that add increased expenses. And as a result, it undermines their productivity, or I should say their competitiveness, and leads to job losses. Well, indeed, it is the case that regulations that can require businesses to comply with stricter pollution regulations, with better health and safety regulations on the job, with higher minimum wages and the like, with paid leave. All of these do involve costs that may be borne on the shoulders of business and diminish the amount of their revenues that go to stockholders and other owners of capital as opposed to employees. But because the Democrats, at least at the center, are not putting forward any program that would guarantee employment to anyone who might be laid off, they have very little to respond to against these criticisms. And this has always come up. You know, whenever there have been struggles over raising the minimum wage, you always get these responses that if you do so, certain businesses are not going to be able to afford it. They're going to have to lay off people. Well, if you have guaranteed jobs, such problems become moot. Because if there are businesses that can't handle it, those who lose their jobs will get employment in the public sector, doing things that are actually going to provide goods and services and increase our human capital that will, if anything, provide a steady amount of consumer demand that will allow business to flourish and provide it with a more invigorating infrastructure. And those kind of difficulties will not be at hand. But Biden and almost all Democratic candidates were not offering any kind of job guarantee. Now, this is crucial with regard to the whole policy of a Green New Deal, because the Green New Deal has the New Deal side of it, which is tied to a job guarantee, the idea that when we make the transition to clean energy, anyone whose livelihood depends upon the fossil fuel industry will have guaranteed employment at a fair wage awaiting them. And this really is a key element if we're going to make a case to the American people that averting the climate catastrophe is something that we can do in a way that is not going to endanger any of our livelihoods. And of course, the onset of climate heating is going to endanger our livelihoods, and perhaps much more than our livelihoods in years to come. Now, the other part of it is healthcare. You know, Biden, like most candidates running for office in the Democratic Party, have not come out in support of a Medicare for All program, but are still hanging on to Obamacare, speaking about a public option. Well, Trump could correctly criticize Biden for offering health solutions that are not adequate. that, first of all, do not give you choice of any doctor you want, that don't cover everyone, that don't deal with the problem that people have health insurance that is tied to employment, and that connection has not been severed through Obamacare. In various ways, the fact that Obamacare is not a solution, but is still being offered as something to be built upon, is something that put the Democratic agenda very much in jeopardy. Because the Republicans could criticize them and show that this is not providing us with affordable health care. You still have copays, you still have deductibles, and of course you have premiums that are growing. And it has not allowed us to bring our costs anywhere in line with those of the rest of the world. Medicare for All solves all these problems because it has no copays, no deductibles, no premiums properly, if it's properly formulated. It covers everything. It allows everyone to be covered, unlike Obamacare, with the same fair access to all necessary medical services, physical, mental, dental, long-term care. And besides allowing you to go to any healthcare practitioner with complete freedom, it cuts out all the overhead costs of competing for-profit health insurance plans and puts us in a strong, united position to negotiate prices downward in line with the rest of the world with pharmaceutical companies and healthcare providers. All of that can be laid out very clearly and provide a strong case for how we can solve our health problems, which now are more of a problem than ever before in face of a pandemic, where now millions of people are not only facing a health crisis for which they don't have adequate insurance coverage, but millions more are losing jobs to which health insurance was formerly attached, and they find themselves now unprotected. Now, I think these are key measures in the messaging of centrist Democrats like Biden that enabled Trump and his allies to present themselves as if they were the ones who are going to be providing for the economic security of Americans, that they were the ones who were going to provide a solution to the healthcare needs of people, and that the Democrats were not offering proper solutions.
Centrist Dems spend a lot of energy trying to rally up grassroots movements, but then typically when they get elected, they'll realign towards the center, because a lot of the grassroots movements that we've been seeing might be courting towards BLM or even the Sunrise Movement, movement towards environmental change, reacting to climate change, towards a Green New Deal, something like that. There's been a mini debate, shall I say, and sort of the commentary on this, particularly those with left-leaning, Democratic-leaning, AOC being a big member of the more progressive side of this debate, we'll say, and then maybe Joe Biden as representing a more center candidate. A lot of the blame of losses, though, wasn't exactly on failings and policies, or at least she didn't outline the problems as being with failing and policies like you have. I tend to agree with you, giving real solutions to real problems is always more effective than talking about what she talked about, which was campaign strategy. She said that spending certain amounts of money on particular campaigns with certain failures. And a lot of people also point that to a failure of the 2016 election. Somehow Biden was able to get it right, but I don't know. I don't know how you feel about, I guess you might have an opinion on it, given that you weren't able to be a darling of the establishment, as you say. But mismanagement seems to be a little bit rampant, not just policy, but at least according to those on the left. I don't know exactly how I'm convinced I am of that, but I guess my question would be, in association with AOC's position, to what extent can we blame maybe strategic failures? And then against that, in what ways can centrist Democrats be correct in their take that these progressive policies or maybe these progressive counterattacks are splitting the party or maybe drawing attention from things that matter, like simply turning places blue?
Well, I think, first of all, one has to keep in mind that the three measures I spoke of, the three policy positions I spoke of, which can be convincingly argued for in a way that disable the criticisms that Trump and his allies could direct at Biden and similar Democratic candidates. You know, they consist of really the idea of a federal job guarantee, guaranteed jobs at fair wages, the idea of a Medicare for all, and the idea of a Green New Deal, which contains the idea of a federal job guarantee. It's important to recognize that none of these policies involve anything that could be aptly called socialism. They all remain in the framework of an economy that has a public and a private sector. And you see this with each of these. You take, first of all, the federal job guarantee. It is offering employment in the public sector alongside a for-profit private sector when the for-profit private sector is failing to provide employment to people, which increases and decreases according to the situation of the business cycle. But it's a perennial fact of the way markets operate. And when we talk about a federal job guarantee, we're not talking about in any way removing or diminishing or replacing the private sector. We're rather speaking about taking a remedial action where the government steps in as an employer of last resort and to do something that in a way empowers the private sector. Because what does it do? It ensures that everyone has an income. It acts as a stabilizer where by providing jobs to people in recessions or depressions, it prevents the danger of deflation. Because when everyone who can work has a job and we have replacement income for those who cannot, everyone has disposable income, which means that markets are not going to involve the destructive forces of deflation, such as afflict pretty much any nation that encounters a depression, as ours did, and which then wrecks business and accelerates the process of the destruction of wealth. On the other hand, when business picks up, thanks to the fact that we have a public sector remedy for unemployment, then the public sector will be decreasing in size as more employees can move back into the private sector. And that acts as a counter to inflation because it allows government spending to diminish. Now, the same thing with regard to the character of Medicare for All. It does not involve nationalization of let's say, the sector of medical services. All it does is what Medicare and Medicaid have done. Namely, you have a single-payer health insurance that is administered by the government, but it leaves in place all of the private sector doctors, nurses, clinics, hospitals, etc., drug companies, and the like. It in no way eliminates that sector. If anything, it simplifies their operations. It lowers their costs of having to deal with, you know, this vast array of competing for-profit health insurance plans. It in all respects also will allow for healthcare practitioners to operate everywhere because there will not be places in the country where people will not have the funds to pay for the medical care they need. Medicare for All will provide that. So here, again, we have a policy that does not involve any elimination of private enterprise other than that pertaining to for-profit health insurance plans, which have been shown to be detrimental to public health and, to some extent, to the for-profit health and drug industry. Because it robs people of their ability to enter the marketplace for medical care. And then, of course, the same thing applies to the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is not something that is going to diminish the for-profit or private sector as it applies to energy, extraction, energy production, the production of appliances that make use of energy. It's going to be using both private enterprise and public investment to make a transition that obviously is vital for the life of humanity on this planet. And, you know, we saw how throughout this campaign, the Republicans were accusing Biden and any other Democratic candidate of being socialists and communists. And that obviously has no truth to it, because none of the policies being put forward by centrists or more so-called progressive Democrats involved eliminating capitalism. All of their policies, from Bernie Sanders to Rand Paul, always involved the framework of an economy that had a public and a private sector. And I think there is tremendous confusion on both the right and left on the way in which socialism is bandied about.
To what extent could we claim the terminology of social democracy, something similar to in Europe?
Well, I think that also is a term that is very confusing, because it gets alluded to people claiming that they're anti-capitalists, mm-hmm. which is not the case, or that they're socialists, as if socialism represented something other than having a mixed economy and basically allowing markets to operate in a way in which, let's say, they have a human face, they serve equal opportunity. And I think if we turn to the left, we find ways in which the so-called left-leaning progressive wing of the Democratic Party presented its policies in a way that I think is very detrimental to the cause they are really fighting for. One has to do with calling themselves socialists, because the term is completely misleading. They are all capitalist rotors. That's true of AOC. That's true of Bernie Sanders. That's true of everyone in all the small groups that align themselves with this wing of the Democratic Party. They're all capitalist rotors who accept a mixed economy, who accept for-profit enterprise. And anyone who thinks not is either just lying or deluded. And I think it is a big mistake on the part of people in that wing of the Democratic Party to use this term, to even present themselves as it being anti-capitalist, because it shows their ignorance of the different forms that capitalism can take. You know, capitalism is not identical with laissez-faire economics, where we let the market go its free way. Markets are always operating within a domain in which you have government, in which you have public institutions. And the moment you have public institutions presiding over the market, or in other words, a state, as well as bodies of that pertain to the civil administration of our society, you automatically have a public sector. I work at the University of Georgia. I'm a public sector employee. The Bulldogs are a public sector operation. And even Hayek, Rand Paul, libertarians, all of them recognize that the economy is never simply something that can consist of for-profit enterprises. It always involves a public sector, and it can't survive without a public sector. The question is, how is the public sector going to relate to the private sector? Now, I think there are various things that were put forward on the progressive side of politics that I think also played a significant role in preventing a blue wave from occurring. And I think two of the things that I think played a role are the way in which the Black Lives Matter unfolded in this huge upsurge of largely peaceful demonstrations, which were occasioned by instances of police violence, killing in particular African Americans, and with it the call for defunding police. I think both of these campaigns presented slogans and failed to provide slogans that were completely vague and imprecise and did not in any way lead us or present the true solutions to the systemic racism that they were largely attempting to expose. and that they had a certain counterproductive aspect to them because of that. Now, if we take to begin with the Black Lives Matter movement and this huge uprising that followed in these last months, which in a sense was very stirring because it took place under a pandemic. It showed that people were not going to be completely stifled. They would rise up and protest injustice. Of course, what they were protesting was not anything new. I mean, the United States has annually police killings on a scale that no other developed nation has. We have more than 1,000 people killed by police every year. A quarter of the victims are African American. And these killings go on without any degree of proper accountability. And you see that through the following statistic that a recent study showed. Since 2005, about 15,000 people have been killed by police in America. In only 44 cases were the police ever brought to any kind of trial. And in many of the cases, they did not receive guilty verdicts of any great significance. So that certainly shows there's no need for any type of special allowances for police. Rather, there is a need to hold them accountable. But, you know, if you ask yourself, why is there this degree of police violence in America, which is 30 times the per capita rate of police killings and violence in Great Britain, more than 50 times the per capita rate in Japan? You know, I think there are really two broad reasons. And these are two broad reasons that I think go beyond explicit racism on the part of the police personnel themselves. I mean, after all, in many of the instances of police killing, the police who are involved, first of all, they're not all white. In the case of Floyd, there were four police involved. One was African-American, one was Asian-American. I think the problem goes beyond simply explicit racist feelings on the part of police personnel, not to say that such things don't exist. But it largely has to do with the fact that we tolerate a degree of poverty that goes beyond that of any other democracy in the developed world. And at the same time, we tolerate a proliferation of guns among the public that does not exist in any other country to a comparable degree. And that means our police are being used to keep the lid on all of these social pathologies that the toleration of mass poverty brings with it. And to do so in an environment where police can fear that anyone they're encountering has a deadly weapon. And I think you put those two things together and put them as well in together with the fact that people of color are disproportionately impoverished. You have a recipe for a institutionally racist police oppression that is something more than a residue or an expression of racist attitudes on the part of police departments themselves. Now, of course, there is the problem of accountability of the police. And, you know, that is part of the demands of the Black Lives Matter movement. But what the Black Lives Matter movement never really formulated are the measures that can eliminate institutional racism. I remember going to a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Athens, and most of the speakers were basically saying, what do we have to do to combat the oppression of people of color? Well, we have to enforce our civil rights legislation, and we have to make the police accountable. Well, that completely leaves out the measures that are necessary to eliminate institutional racism. And they have two basic sides. One has to do with nullifying the continuation of the wage and income gap between black and white, which also pertains to the wage and income gap between men and women. And the other side of things, that all the services and factors you need in order to exercise your freedoms and have opportunity are allowed to depend in this country on how much wealth and money you have. And that means if the Black Lives Matter really wanted to present the real solutions, It would be providing a social rights agenda that benefits everyone and thereby has the possibility of a degree of support that would not be found elsewhere. And I think that is something that is a key problem. And the other problem is the slogan of defunding the police. Because obviously those who are putting it forward, they want not just police to be accountable, but they want public safety to be provided for. And public safety is not provided for by the police, simply. It's provided by ensuring that people have access to health care, that they have a roof over their head, that they have access to all the services they need in order to be secure. And those resources involve public funding that goes far beyond the resources of municipal police budgets. But the idea of defunding the police as a way of framing the whole idea of escaping police violence and having genuine safety and security really shackles the whole platform to something that is fundamentally inadequate. Because first of all, there are things the police should be doing that may require additional funding. And let's not forget that police personnel are public employees. They're not particularly well paid. They don't have the greatest benefits. It's not as if they don't deserve to have higher wages and better arrangements of paid leave and so forth, as well as provisions to allow them to become better trained. But when we're talking about the measures that will provide genuine public safety for people, including access to mental health care and the like, these require resources that go well beyond what the city budget can provide. And again, I think the way in which these movements framed their positions left them open to the kind of manipulation that Trump and the Republican Party did by presenting it as if this was an invitation to anarchy, to destroying police, to eliminating any situation of law and order. And of course, what contributed to this was the fact that at some demonstrations, even though the vast majority of demonstrators were perfectly peaceful, even though they were subject to riots on the part of police who perpetrated violence upon them, which was not at all necessary, there were instances where people, you know, broke windows, engaged in certain amounts of looting. There were, of course, cases of right-wing provocateurs who engaged in this. But there was an element of that, and this was a gift to Trump. Just as similar things were a gift to Nixon back in the late 60s, when he would come to electoral victory. So this was something that really allowed Trump and the Republican parties to present themselves as a law and order party and put Democrats in a way on a defensive when they really did not need to be on the defensive. And I think all of these matters are failures on the part of progressive elements in the Democratic Party who failed to really present the kind of social rights agenda, including a federal job guarantee, as key elements for eliminating systemic racism. And all of these remedies are a matter of rights that have not been enforced for anyone. And for that very reason, when you advance them, you are advancing something that can very easily be shown to be of benefit to everyone, at the same time that they are of disproportionate benefit to those who have been most oppressed, namely people of color and women, as well as that sector of the white population that have been suffering from poverty that is intergenerational as well.
As somebody who wasn't able to maybe witness some of these past movements, it's really nice to be able to hear comparisons like that and seeing gifts on the progressive side. I'm personally torn, I suppose, about the BLM, Black Lives Matter movement. I feel this just immense sense of compassion for my neighbor, right? That's part of the movement. But At the same time, I think it's really important to note that successful movements will always promise something for everybody. I think there has to be skin in the game for these people. Of course, it's nice to know that your friend, your neighbors will not die at the hands of police officers, but it's also important to notice, as I mean, I don't really watch SNL, but Chappelle had a poignant monologue talking about how white angst is exigent, obviously. I mean, life expectancy is going down for the first time in the history of America for whites, and people are out of jobs, and it really calls to this question of not just justice, civil rights justice, but justice and jobs. Jobs, maybe even first, could have been a wonderful way to bring skin into the game for the Black Lives Matter. And I mean skin as a nice pun, but I mean also as a really important aspect of this.
I mean, I think this is a key part of the way in which the pandemic, which has exploded largely because of the criminal mismanagement of the Trump administration and his allies in Congress, has been something that Trump and his Republican allies have been able to use for their own political advantage. Because as he showed in his debate with Biden, he could very effectively point out that Biden is someone who is speaking about having the possibility of restrictions on commercial activity that could cause people to lose income, cause businesses to not be able to have the revenues they need. And Biden, like many other Democrats, was not providing the commitment to ensure that if we have to restrict economic activity in order to contain the pandemic and the spread of the coronavirus, that we are going to do so only in conjunction with guaranteeing income to everyone involved. And that means, on the one hand, providing jobs where they can be provided safely to anyone who loses employment, providing replacement income to those who can't work, providing subsidies to business so they can make it through this period. And if you combine that with rather strict safety precautions, you know, one could theoretically contain the pandemic in a matter of months, as China succeeded in doing, as many other countries have succeeded in doing. But again, because there was no commitment to guaranteeing people a livelihood, to guaranteeing people a roof over their heads, to guaranteeing people continued medical care, it was very easy for Trump and his Republican allies to present to the American people the specter of Democrats depriving them of their livelihoods by trying to shut things down. And thereby they were able to present this opposition between being responsible to taking the kind of precautions that can diminish the spread of the coronavirus and what it means for people to be able to maintain themselves economically, right? These should not be separated. These should not be allowed to be opposed to one another. But I'm afraid that Biden allowed them to be opposed, and so did many other Democratic candidates, because they were not willing to provide any guarantees of employment and replacement income and the kind of subsidies that were provided. Admittedly, the Democrats were pushing for a bigger package in the CARE Act and the Republicans. But the package was not complete. It was not sufficient. It was not tied to an affirmation of rights, of subsistence. And I think that's a big problem we're facing. Now, of course, the hope for having the genuine solutions be discussed and adopted just to a large degree is going to hinge upon what happens now in Georgia, in these two Senate races, one of which I was involved in as one of the candidates who did not fare well. And I think it's important and interesting to discuss what happened in these races and what now can be done in having a runoff in which Democrats could be victorious. and then present a situation where the Biden presidency will be able to overcome the obstructions coming from Mitch McConnell and be able to forge ahead, as this perfect storm is going to be pushing our nation to forge ahead if it can wake up sufficiently to what we're facing.
Right. So one of the primary ones, one of the first things to talk about, the race that you were in, the seat for the special election for Georgia's, one of Georgia's seats in the United States Senate, currently held by the race is being tossed up between a Warnock, who was significantly ahead of Kelly Loeffler, who is the current holder of that position. But there was a split, right, in the status of the race is that there was a split in the Republican Party. Doug Collins decided that he was going to try and take on Loeffler from maybe a more center-right position. And then, of course, there's Warnock, who decided to team up with a hefty amount of Democratic spending and with the Democratic Party as somebody who picked up on, a pseudo-legacy of sorts of what Martin Luther King brought forth, who did advocate for social rights agendas, while Warnock did nothing of the sort and merely ran a campaign on, normalcy or something like this. Anyway, that seems to be the status of it. My guess would be that as soon as Collins and Loeffler supporters combine, there will be a clear victor in Loeffler.
But I think it's, first of all, I think it's important to look at the figures for what has happened in both of these Senate races. And again, I'm relying on the figures that are in today's New York Times, where 98% of the vote has come in. And keep in mind, Biden is ahead in Georgia. He has a lead of over 10,000 votes, which means that he had received so far 49.5% of the vote, whereas Trump received 49.3% of the vote, approximately. Interestingly enough, even though everyone was going to the polls to vote for both the presidency and everything down ballot, there was a significant, not a huge, but a significant decrease in people who voted in the two Senate races. That is, in the regular Senate race, where Ossoff was facing Perdue, more than 1% of those who voted for the president did not vote in this race at all. And in the special Senate race, about 1.7% of those who voted in the presidential race simply did not neglected to cast a vote in the special election. Now, also what I think is significant is that in the regular Senate race, where you had the incumbent Perdue running against the winner of the Democratic primary, Ossoff, Perdue actually got more votes than Trump. Not by a large amount, but he got about 700 or 800 more votes than Trump did. And his percentage was higher than Biden's. That is, he got 49.7% of the vote. Ossoff got 47.9% of the vote. And one of the reasons Perdue was not able to win in this round was that the Libertarian candidate, Hazel, received 2.3% of the vote. Now, in the special election, as I mentioned, more voters simply did not bother voting in it. I'll just say anecdotally something that might have something to do with that. I'm not sure. But I had gone at the very end of my campaign to the offices of one of the Democratic county organizations and went there to distribute some literature and so forth. I spoke to the person who's in charge, and he happens to be on the Board of Elections. And as you probably know, contrary to some of the propaganda coming from Trump and his legal aides who are contesting the legitimacy of the election, at every kind of voter election board, You have one Democrat, one Republican, and one neutral observer there involved in counting the ballots. And this person happened to be the Democratic representative. And he told me that they were finding that a significant number of people who were voting in the special election, where you have 21 candidates, of which I was one, you had 8 Democrats, you had 6 Republicans. Well, if they were voting Democratic, they would end up putting their marks on all 8 of the Democrats, or if they were Republican, putting their marks on all 6 of the Republicans. Now, I wonder if that's one of the reasons why 1.5% of those who voted for the presidency did not end up casting a proper vote for the Senate on their mail-in ballots. But anyway, one thing to recognize in the special Senate race, which I was in and had 21 voters, is that Loeffler ended up coming in second with 25.9% of the vote out of a total of 2,349,964 votes cast for the 6 Republican candidates. That total, by the way, was 47.96% of votes cast. So that was very different from the other Senate race, where Perdue got 49.7% of the vote and Ossoff got 47.9%. Here, it was somewhat of a reverse situation. The 6 Republican candidates got less votes total than the Democratic candidates, all 8 of us. The Republicans got, as I mentioned, 47.96%. The Democratic candidates, all 8 of us, received about 21,000 more votes than the Republican candidates. We accounted for 48.38% of the vote. That's 2,370,015. Warnock ended up getting 32.9% of the total, with 1,621,843 votes. That was 68% of the Democratic total. Now, there are many people who were continually accosting down-ballot Democrats like myself who were not simply paying homage to Warnock and dropping out of the race. Often there was a claim that there was a risk of spoiling where 2 Republicans would end up the runoff. That very quickly became something that had no real possibility once the Democratic establishment converged into supporting Warnock and putting all their resources behind them. But also there were others who said, well, these other Democratic candidates should drop out so that Warnock could gain election in the first round without having to go to a runoff. But I think that was also fundamentally unrealistic, because the total Democratic vote in this election, as I mentioned, was only 48%. And in the presidential race in Georgia, even though Biden triumphed, he himself got 49.5%. And you have to keep in mind, you have libertarians, you have a small Green Party, you have a bunch of independents. It was really not in the cards for any candidate to be able to make it through without a runoff. Now, one thing regarding this race that one has to keep in mind is the way in which money really predominated. Now, we have to recognize that in our rather corrupt political system, where access to the voters hinges upon how much money you have, that is not going to mean that you can buy an election. Bloomberg could put an unheard amount of money into his race for the presidency, but he was not the only candidate who had enough funds to get their positions and name out to the voters. And as a result, he was not able to triumph. But in this race, as in many races, the only people who can get enough funding to make their presence known are those who are among the establishment candidates. I'm talking about Loeffler and Collins on the Republican side. And to begin with, Lieberman and eventually Warnock on the Democratic side. Lieberman entered first. He raised over $1 million, in some part due to the contacts through his father, Joe Lieberman. But once the Democratic establishment put all its energies in support of Warnock, he was able to spend more than $10 million on TV ads. No one else in the race could come anywhere close to that. So it, in a way, it's kind of striking that he only arrived at 68% of the vote. And I think one has to raise the question, why did he do relatively poorly? Why did it take him so long to be able to get above the 23% threshold you need to enter the runoff, and then to end up with you know, no more than a share of 32.9% of the vote? And I think, again, it has to do with how he's putting himself out as a candidate. Because he's presenting a candidacy that, in many respects, is like that of Biden. He's not supporting any true solutions to our healthcare crisis. He's not coming out for Medicare for All. Instead, he will talk about in his advertisements of the need to extend Medicaid coverage in Georgia. But, I mean, that's kind of absurd for a Senate candidate to be putting forward, because that's a matter of the state government, which is authorized under the ACA to, if it wants to, extend Medicaid coverage and overcome a certain kind of gap for people of low income, but not as low as those who qualify in the first instance for Medicaid. So in a way, he's not providing really convincing solutions to the healthcare crisis that we are facing with ever more urgency. He also has not come out with any kind of guaranteed job program, which is all the more painful since he is, after all, the minister at Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King had presided, and where Martin Luther King, in his last year, was a particularly strong advocate of a federal job guarantee. And as Martin Luther King said, if you don't have a job and a decent income, you have neither life nor liberty nor the ability to pursue happiness. Well, Warnock is not putting forward a federal job guarantee nor a Green New Deal, which is associated with that. And I think all of these things make his candidacy less powerful than it could be. And I'm afraid the same thing is true of John Ossoff. They, to some degree, are weakening their appeal and weakening their ability to win over some of those voters who have turned to Donald Trump because of his claim that he will bring jobs back to America, and who have seen the Democratic Party fail to end unemployment and to end the erosion in incomes that has been steadily progressing since the 1970s. So I think, you know, we're now facing a situation where Biden has shown us, in a sense, more than Stacey Abrams had shown her in her close race for the governorship, that Democrats can win statewide races in Georgia. And they can win them even if their messaging is less than perfect, as certainly was the case in the Biden presidency. So we are in a situation where I think we can feel that there is a real opportunity of doing something that often is said Democrats don't do in Georgia, namely win a runoff. You know, I think we're in a position where we have two races, each of which could send a Democrat to the Senate. But that is going to require a massive ground game and, I think, an improvement in the messaging. And I would think that it's important for Ossoff and Warnock to speak in a more convincing way about what their policies will be to fulfill our right to health care, what their policies will be to eliminate the housing crisis and the threat of homelessness that more and more people are facing. That they provide more convincing solutions to the problem of joblessness and deteriorating incomes that so many people face. And in that connection, more convincing solutions of how they're going to mitigate the climate catastrophe we're facing. I think if they can stand up and move in that direction and indicate at the same time that none of this has anything to do with eliminating the private sector, it has nothing to do with eliminating capitalism. What it has to do is giving capitalism a human face and providing economic prosperity for everyone. I think that is a winning message. And if we reflect back on why there was not a blue wave in this time of a perfect storm with the most corrupt, incompetent president in American history, I think that provides us a road to victory in these two Senate races, and then puts us in a position to push the new Democratic administration further along the road of really providing the general solutions that a job guarantee social rights agenda provides.
I was wondering if you'd be able to speak a little bit about the specifics of your race and what you saw as crucial moments and crucial dynamics in the campaign that you ran.
You know, in my race, there were 21 candidates. And that contributed to the way in which money could dominate this election. Because only the establishment candidates had anywhere near sufficient money to get known to the public through a barrage of TV ads. In conjunction with this, the pandemic shut down most in-person campaign activities, which also greatly restricted the free opportunities to meet the public that candidates normally can make use of. In addition, our free press completely betrayed its democratic duty to inform the electorate of what their options really are, of who the other candidates are and what they stand for. And all of these things together made it extremely difficult for those who were not awash with money to get known to the voters. And the fact that there were 21 candidates made it all the more difficult because one was lost in the crowd. And even when there were events that were organized for campaign forums, the fact that there were so many candidates meant that each candidate had hardly any time to present themselves in a serious way. So all these factors contributed to allowing big money to dominate on both sides of this electoral process and allow the establishment favorite on the Democratic side to meet the most wealthy Republican establishment favorite in the runoff. And that's where we are. But I think we have to support the Democrats who are in this race because they are much more amenable to the genuine solutions we need. And it's crucial that they succeed in this runoff and allow the Biden presidency to have a Senate that will pass the legislation it will be seeking to put before the public.
So we've gone over quite a bit.
But
as just one thing that's sort of burning a hole in my mind, I guess.
Yeah.
What's the Trump's lost? What's the legacy of Trumpism? I mean, or at least do you think? Of course, this will be entirely speculation. The only real institutions that have formed based off of Trumpism, if that's even going to be a thing, is something like a Turning Point USA. But it doesn't seem to have any kind of traction power. I mean, do you see any sort of echoes besides just a kind of remembrance of maybe a dark period in American history that Trump might have?
Well, I'll tell you where we find his legacy most entrenched. That's in our judiciary. Because he, in conjunction with the work of Mitch McConnell during the years of the Obama administration, have succeeded in preventing Democrats from making any appointments in the federal judiciary to speak of, and putting in extremely conservative Republicans who subscribe to an agenda where government really should have its hands off the economy as much as possible and not really allow for a social rights agenda to be fulfilled. Now, we saw that despite having power for 4 years, Trump really was unable to implement hardly any legislation And that, in a sense, was completely eliminated when the Democrats came roaring back in the 2018 elections and at least regained control of the House of Representatives. But he really wasn't able to make legislative changes that we are stuck with. But what he did do is put in place a huge number of executive orders that have really done everything to promote oligarchy in the sense of withdrawing all restrictions on the operations of our economy or all restrictions of how private wealth can be used to both make use of government to its own advantage and to undercut the opportunities of everyone else. All of these executive orders can be immediately rescinded and replaced by Joe Biden the moment he takes over power. And I think he's going to do so. And in that way, he will do something that will very quickly obliterate many of the sabotage that Trump has inflicted on our government. On the other hand, we have to contend with the pandemic and all the economic harm its mismanagement has been led to produce. And that is something we are stuck with and we're going to be stuck with in the next months to come until Joe Biden takes over. And that, alas, is one of the heritages that Trump has allowed us, a degree of death and destitution that we need not have ever had. And then there is the fomenting and complicity with the rising fascist movement in the United States and its counterparts abroad. Because Trump himself and many of his inner circle, and together with the acquiescence of most of the Republican Party, have been turning a blind eye to the rise of far-right seditious movements that are armed to the teeth. And Trump has, of course, not just turned a blind eye, but in a way done what he could to legitimate them and often advance their agenda by villainizing immigrants, by villainizing people in color in general. And I think that is something we have to contend with, and that Trump has left us with the collusion of much of the Republican Party. So we have our work cut out for us. But I think we are in a situation where, especially if we do well in these two Senate runoff elections, we are going to be in a position to really turn this country around and overcome much of the damage that Donald Trump and his collaborators have inflicted upon us and the world. And of course, one of the greatest things that we have to attend to is Donald Trump's attempt to sabotage any effort whatsoever to mitigate climate change. And I think the Biden presidency can begin to reverse that inaction and added damage. And we need to push them to go all the way.